This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Morgan. I'm an editor at Ahval News, and this is Turkey Abroad. Joining me today is Nicholas Danforth. He's a non-resident research fellow at the ELIAMAP think tank in Athens, but he is calling in from Washington, D.C. Nicholas, yes. Welcome to Turkey Abroad.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So yesterday, we finally got our response from President Erdogan with his first remarks basically on Joe Biden's recognition of the Armenian genocide over the weekend. And he gave some of the usual defenses for what happened in 1915 as to why, in his view, it did not count as genocide. He invited the U.S. to send researchers to look at the Turkish archives and, of course, included some accusations of hypocrisy based on the U.S.'s own history. But that said, the overall Turkish reaction hasn't been nearly as apoplectic as many might have feared. And Erdogan himself said he looks forward to opening a new door with Joe Biden in June when they meet at the sidelines of a NATO summit. So what do you think about Turkey and Erdogan's responses to the change in U.S. recognition of the Armenian genocide on Saturday? What are your thoughts?
No, that's a good summary of it. It was not apocalyptic. For 30 years, we've been hearing that, you know, even when the U.S.-Turkish relationship was strong, were a U.S. president to take this step, it would be catastrophic. It would blow up the relationship. Turkey would sever ties, close İncirlik and military cooperation. The fact that Erdogan hasn't done this is good news. In a way that particular strain on the relationship right now may have actually muted the response. We've seen over the past 5 or 6 months, the Turkish government has been on a charm offensive, speaking optimistically about a reset with Washington, having a minor reset with the EU, claiming it's going to improve ties with Egypt, with Saudi Arabia, even announcing it might have, however implausibly, a new diplomatic breakthrough with Armenia. Against this backdrop, it did seem like Erdogan was going to be hesitant to really respond dramatically to the genocide announcement. And as you said, the fact that he was willing to say that, you know, he still looks forward to meeting Biden, he's still talking about a positive agenda, reinforces this. I mean, I don't think that means we're out of the woods. I don't think it means there's not a possibility something else will go wrong in the relationship. At some point down the line, Erdogan's going to take more steps to antagonize Washington for one thing or another. You know, when he does, maybe he'll cite this as justification. But yes, long story short, he just didn't decide to blow up the relationship yet.
Yet it seems to be the key word, especially when some of the reactions that I've seen so far have to try to explain why the Turkish response almost looked like their previous responses to, say, the Armenian genocide recognition resolutions from Congress, almost word for word, they seem very familiar on that sense. But we had a panel over the weekend after the announcement that tried to decipher really why the Turkish reaction was what it was, basically. And do you think it was particularly important that Biden spoke to Erdogan beforehand to give him something of a heads up that he was going to change the U.S. stance on the genocide? And how would you assess the way that President Biden and his administration rolled out this announcement?
Look, let me start by saying I thought the announcement itself was impeccably done. Biden, you know, clearly they put a lot of thought into crafting Biden's statement. I thought it was a very concise and powerful statement. The fact that he clearly went out of his way to focus on the victims, to focus on the experiences, subsequent contributions of Armenian Americans, rather than try to weaponize this against Turkey, I think was important. You know, as other people have commented, the fact that the word Turkey didn't even come up in the course of the statement, clearly, and you know, I know they emphasized this in the call with Erdogan, clearly trying to say that this was about history. This was about a U.S. president commenting on what is, you know, the personal history of American citizens rather than trying to pick a fight with Turkey, rather than trying to punish Erdogan. You know, those were all positive steps. I'm glad Biden was responsible with his rhetoric to the extent that he was able to convey any of that to Erdogan, to the extent that he was able to try to put a positive gloss on things in his call with Erdogan. You know, again, this was the promise of the Biden administration, which so far on this issue he's living up to. You know, it was going to be more principled. It was going to be less deferential to Erdogan. But also, you know, he's not reckless. He's a responsible statesman. And that also comes through in the way that he's handled the rollout of this.
On that note, it did give me a thought that the way he gave Erdogan this heads up, so to speak, before going ahead with his announcement, it made me think about right before the United States issued its visa sanctions on the Saudi officials involved in Jamal Khashoggi's murder. He had spoken to King Salman beforehand to let him know about it. And it does seem to be a bit of a parallel there. Do you think it's important that Biden is sort of handling his leader-to-leader dialogue in this kind of way by giving this sort of like personal touch to it almost?
Right, and similar with a call with Putin before the rollout of Russian sanctions. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. After Trump, you know, people were saying that Biden's going to reinstitutionalize relations. It's going to be, you know, State Department and the NSC are going to be.
I've heard a number of times on the show.
Right. It's not going to be just the sons-in-law. It's not just going to be the two presidents chatting. You know, I think that's all very important. And that's all very good. You know, of course, the goal isn't to take that personal relationship out of it. You know, it's Biden is president, Erdogan is president. For them to have a functional relationship, for them to be able to talk to each other directly, is enormously important. But, you know, I think what Biden wants to show and what the timing of this call and the other ones you've mentioned emphasizes is that, you know, the personal relationship doesn't have to be a chummy one. You know, Biden and Erdogan should be able to talk. They should be able to talk as world leaders, as adults. Having that personal relationship doesn't mean, as it did under Trump, that Biden is going to do whatever Erdogan tells him to when they have a phone call.
So would you say it's accurate to say that it's sort of looking to strike a balance between the institution-to-institution relationship that many predicted would characterize a Biden approach to Turkey and this personal touch, so to speak? Because I remember very well in 2016 when Joe Biden told The Atlantic that he finds a particular value in having this personal connection with other world leaders. And actually, in that article, he specifically mentioned his ability to speak to Erdogan and referenced how President Obama at the time usually assigned him to speak to Erdogan. And he also helped, as one example, the reconciliation between him and Netanyahu in Israel at the time.
Yeah, and that was what I think the way personal relationships played out under Trump almost gave a bad name to the whole idea of a personal relationship. The implication was that it was something overly friendly. It's sort of a crony to crony relationship. And yes, I mean, what came through in reverse with Trump is that it's important for presidents, leaders to be able to speak clearly to each other. And actually one of the most damaging things under Trump was the fact that sometimes when he had conversations with Erdogan, you'd get completely rival readouts from both governments, and it wouldn't always be clear, you know, especially when you listen to the way Trump talked, that he would have actually communicated a message effectively to his counterpart. You know, the message doesn't have to be a friendly one. It's important that the U.S. president be able to make, you know, his policies, his views, his, you know, red lines clear, and do that personally.
And speaking again about this approach, the Biden approach, so to speak, I think one of the most commonly noted takeaways from our moving to recognize the Armenian genocide is that it's a sign that out of A, Turkey and U.S. relations are at such a nadir, historically speaking, or that Turkey's simply run out of friends in Washington to provide it some cover along the way. And of course, during the Trump years, I think it was CNN who reported that Erdogan had a direct line to the president. Trump told them to prioritize Erdogan over anyone else calling in, basically. And it does seem like he took that to heart. But do you think that now it will, this approach will force Erdogan to really take rebuilding relationship with these other key stakeholders into account, whether it's Congress, whether it's the Pentagon?
You'll see some effort, I think. The fact that for the first time Turkey is now appointed an ambassador who seems to take diplomacy a little more seriously, who seems to actually see improving U.S.-Turkish ties, see being liked in Washington as a goal, is a positive step. You know, there are going to be limits, though. You know, yes, having the, you know, at least making an effort to reach out to the wide swath of stakeholders in Washington certainly will help. Erdogan's positive rhetoric, his talk of a reset is certainly better than the alternative. But, you know, it's not going to be enough on its own. And, you know, the best salesmanship will only go so far when the product you're selling is, you know, not one that people are interested in. And, you know, unfortunately, as we've seen, you know, in talk of Turkish rapprochement with Egypt, you know, even in Turkish EU relations to some extent, you know, what will change the tone of the relationship ultimately is new policies, not outreach.
And that always seems to come back to it with a lot of these rapprochements, is that they'd like to see actions more than nice words, basically. But one podcast I had last week was with Selpi Gazarian. She's over at USC. She's director of the Institute for Armenian Studies there. And she suggested that one of the bigger risks now that their genocide has been recognized might be actually domestically in Turkey, where how this could potentially be used by whether it's the AKP or its ruling partner to justify maybe some more discrimination or riling people up against Armenians in Turkey itself. Of course, it's too soon. We haven't really seen any of that so far. But given the economic problems that Turkey's going through right now, COVID-19 and Erdogan's struggling approval ratings, do you think that the domestic backlash is probably the biggest concern, more so than any direct backlash on U.S.-Turkey relations?
No, I mean, that's clearly a concern. It's something that, you know, we've seen some very frightening rhetoric coming out of people in Turkey. So far, thankfully, at least Erdogan's initial statements vis-a-vis the Armenian community were less provocative than they could have been, you know. But I mean, yeah, the de facto death threats against Garo Paylan for calling for genocide recognition in Congress. I mean, this is certainly something the Armenian community in Turkey is well aware of. This is certainly something people are worried about. You know, all I can say is it's a tribute to the courage of people like Garo that, you know, they've continued to speak out on this. They've continued to call for genocide recognition, even knowing that
the HDP representative said that, right?
Yes. But yeah, the fact that people have been able to continue talking about this, even knowing that it will put, you know, potentially their community and certainly them personally at risk.
Speaking of some of the more domestic Turkish politics side of things, a lot of the opposition parties also spoke out against Biden's decision to recognize the Armenian genocide. Aside from the HDP, had released a statement calling for recognition of it, or at least open space to talk about it. But did it surprise you in any way that CHP, Good Party, or any of the others already reacted in that way to this?
No, not at all. It's funny, a couple of days ago, someone posted something on Twitter saying, you know, Americans should realize 90% of all people in Turkey don't believe it was a genocide. I think a lot of Americans seeing that would have been pleasantly surprised. I mean, a lot of us sort of thought it was like 99.9% that didn't believe it was a genocide. The fact there's almost 10% of people in the country who recognize it's a genocide, I think is actually pretty striking. It shows, sadly, how far the conversation about this has actually come in the last decade or two. You know, the fact that if nothing else, Turkish historians, Turkish academics, Turkish intellectuals, have been able to talk more openly about this in spite of everything that's going on now. And the fact that when you look at the work being produced on the Armenian genocide, I mean, some of the leading scholarship is being done by Turkish scholars based on archival evidence that they're finding in the Ottoman archives. You know, if nothing else, that's progress.
Mm-hmm. You, one of the arguments used by Turkey and supporters after Biden recognized the genocide was that it would hurt any chance of reconciliation with Armenia, which might have prompted many Armenians to blink twice about what reconciliation process they were talking about. You know, of course, beyond just the genocide being recognized by the U.S. on Saturday last year, we had the recent war between Armenia and Azerbaijan over Nagorno-Karabakh as well. And, you know, of course, Turkey backed Azerbaijan in that conflict. But so is it safe to say that this is a counterpoint being raised about a reconciliation process which doesn't actually exist?
Yes, that would be fair. I would say it's a surreal and disingenuous argument. The idea that Turkey expects Armenia is going to go ahead with rapprochement after having just, you know, fought a brutal war in which 4,000 people were killed, and that this isn't going to be an obstacle to rapprochement, but Turkey's, you know, being upset over a non-binding statement made by the U.S. president, suddenly that's what's going to, you know, make it too sensitive for Turkey to pursue rapprochement. I mean,
And, you know, the last thing I'd like to bring up is an assessment that I've seen also, that going by the Turkish reaction to Biden's recognition of the genocide, for all, you know, the warnings about dangerous repercussions, it was fairly measured. And one commentator I saw even on Twitter even put it, it's like, at this point, it's probably not even a top 10 issue in the relationship compared to, say, the S-400, Syria, or maybe even the Halkbank case, which we're going to see resurface soon enough. There's just a whole laundry list of other issues, it seems. And of course, we also have the domestic situation in Turkey to take into account. And since there's still time before Biden and Erdogan meet in June, given everything else that the two have on their plate in the short term, are we still in a position where relationships, the relationship may actually experience more friction before it sees any less?
I mean, it's, I would certainly say it's a situation where we're going to see more friction in the long run. At least the way this has been phrased now, with the fact there's going to be a meeting coming up, the fact that both Erdogan and Biden seem willing to put a positive spin on this, I hope at least means we actually may see less friction before that meeting. Depending on how the meeting goes, if they sit down and talk and realize they still disagree about everything, we could see more friction after that meeting. You know, I guess what I'd say about U.S.-Turkish relationships since Biden came to power is really that, you know, if nothing else, no news is good news. No crises is good news.
Still very much almost like a wait-and-see approach also, it seems.
I mean, exactly. You know, that we haven't, some people were predicting we'd have a reset and everything would be great. Other people, I think, sort of imagined a train wreck from day one. Given that a reset wasn't possible and that a train wreck seemed much more likely, I'm glad at least that things seem to have been quiet. You know, none of the problems have gone away. None of the bigger issues have been solved. They're all still there. We have the Halkbank case coming up. You know, the S-400 sanctions are still in effect. Turkey's talking about buying more S-400s still. The situation in Syria remains unresolved. You know, so again, I mean, it's, every month we go without a new disaster, especially when it's something, we've gone through something as sensitive as genocide recognition without, you know, things getting dramatically worse is good news. But yeah, I mean, I'd expect more friction.
And well, we're taking the wait and see approach. We're probably going to just have to follow along that and see really what ends up transpiring now that we've kind of crossed that bridge with the Armenian genocide. Erdogan has finally got his phone call to Biden and the two are set to meet in June. But until then, it was great to have you here, Nicholas. Yeah, you've come on Evol a number of times with a lot of my other fellow podcasters. So it'll be a pleasure to have you back on this show also.
Thank you so much.
My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. all you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.